comfortable with it. And we have to ask ourselves, I think, why do we face just such adversity? You know, people get uncomfortable with the fact that you're Palestinian before you've even said anything. And in order to understand that a little bit, I think we have to understand just a little bit about the history of Zionism and ethnic cleansing. So when the European Zionists immigrated to Palestine back in the 1800s and in the early 1900s, had their intention been to come and live in Palestine alongside its native inhabitants, we wouldn't have this problem. We probably wouldn't be here today talking about this, but that was not the intention. The intention was to take the land of Palestine exclusive of its native inhabitants. And that required the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. For those of you who are Amen students, I'm sure that you already know this, but ethnic cleansing entails several elements. First is the removal of the population from the land, and the second is to make sure that that population never returns to the land. And they've managed to do that by violating various UN resolutions. But the third thing that's involved in ethnic cleansing is erasing the memory of the people from the land. And that's called memoricide, actually, and there are two ways of doing it. The first is physical. That's literally uprooting olive trees, changing the names of the streets from Arabic to more Hebrew-sounding names, demolishing homes, displacing Palestinians out of their homes and replacing them with Jewish settlers. So that's one of the ways that it's done physically. But another way is doing it intellectually. So in people's minds, the Zionists had to erase Palestinians from Palestine. And the way they did that is to change the narrative. If you grew up with the narrative that Israel was, quote, just defending itself, then you know this. Another example of that is that Palestinians are an invented people. Palestine was a vacant lot. It was a land without a people for a people without a land. And these are the methods used to change the narrative, to erase our memory from Palestine. Literally, memoricide means getting rid of any trace of the other, and that's the intention. The intention also is to dehumanize by calling us terrorists, by saying that we use our children as human shields. And it's exactly this dehumanization and it's exactly this false narrative that has led not only to the conditions of apartheid and mass killing in Palestine, but also to the world's silence in the face of this oppression. This is why Palestinians and others who are working so hard to achieve equality face such adversity upon voicing your opinion, upon telling the truth, or upon just saying who you are. And this dehumanization is not unique to Palestinians. It's taking place right here in the United States. It's taking place against all people of color on the streets of Baltimore, on the streets of Ferguson, on the streets of New York, Chicago, Philadelphia. It's the same system that's seeking to dehumanize us all in the name of profit. So to be treated than less than human, to have that happen to you, or to witness that happening to somebody else, causes something inside of you to shift. Once you've seen it and once you've felt it, you can't unsee it, you can't go back. And you can't, at least I couldn't, just sit back without at least speaking up against it. When I was younger, my family and I, we spent a lot of our summers, almost every summer actually, in Jordan and in Palestine. We spent a lot more of our time on the Jordanian side of the border, though, and here's why. My dad's family, which is the Palestinian side of the family, my mother's side is Jordanian, but my father's family, like so many others, most of them left Palestine because the situation there was untenable for them. There was no work, there were soldiers in the streets, people were being arrested, the economy was terrible, they were afraid for their children, and so they left, they moved to Jordan. But my grandfather still lived there. And when we were kids, we would go visit him. And another one of the reasons why we didn't spend a lot of our time in Palestine, why we spent most of it in Jordan, was because going to visit Palestine was so difficult. The Israelis made it difficult. We would have to cross through Jordan on the Allenby Bridge, and we were routinely held for 8+ hours. We're talking about 2 adults and 5 young children. We were strip searched. So I have memories of being taken to a room. It's 5 girls and my mom and then my dad. So all of us, the girls, we'd be taken to one room. We'd be strip searched. I have memories of us waiting around without our clothing to be patted down. And then my dad would be taken to a separate room to also be strip searched. And then when he would come out of that room, he had this horrible look on his face as if he felt guilty that we were being subjected to this, as if it was somehow his fault. Once the strip search was over, they would empty our suitcases. They would take every single thing out of the suitcase one by one. We're talking about five suitcases because we're a family of seven. So they'd take every single thing out, they'd inspect it, and then my mother would have to repack it after already having spent I don't know how much time packing a suitcase for five kids. And then once that phase was over, there was the interrogation. And the person who was interrogated the most was my father. Why are you here? Where are you from? Who are you visiting? Are you from here? Where are you staying? And then what is your father's name? What is his father's name? Mind you, these are questions that I don't even know that I'd be able to answer beyond my grandfather once they start asking, you know, what's your great-grandfather's name? And these are all questions intended to harass. So when that portion of the program was over, we would still be held for 6-8 hours. The trip from Amman to my grandfather's tiny village in Palestine is approximately 2 hours. A trip that should take 2 hours would take a minimum of 10 because of this harassment. So then we'd pass through, finally we wouldn't be on the border anymore. We'd pass through and then we'd have to go through checkpoints to get to my grandfather's village. And the checkpoints then weren't nearly what they are now. They're actually way worse now. And then we'd get to the village. It's a tiny little predominantly Christian village. And you can walk it in about 10 minutes. It doesn't take a long time. The Israelis regularly imposed a curfew on the village, and then they would drive through in their jeeps, in their armored jeeps, to make sure that the curfew was being enforced and that nobody was out past the time that they were supposed to be. There was one electricity generator in Zababda, and the Israelis would shut it down every night. On occasion, they would cut off the water supply. And I think the thing that I remember the most about visiting Palestine, or the thing that stands out the most in my memory, is going to the bigger town. So we wouldn't spend all of our time in Zababda because there's really nothing to do there, and we were kids, so we'd whine and complain until our parents took us elsewhere. So we'd go to Ramallah, we'd go sometimes to Jenin, sometimes we'd travel into Israel. But I remember being in Jerusalem and in Ramallah and seeing soldiers, fully armed soldiers, just walking around, patrolling the streets. And this was really, it's a weird thing, because I didn't see that in Jordan. And I didn't see that in the United States, and it struck me as this is not normal. And also in my mind, I didn't ask any of the soldiers this question, but in my mind, my thought was, well, these guys are armed, and they don't like me. They don't like my family, simply because of who we are. They don't want us there. They've made that clear. So it wasn't all terrible, though. We had a lot of great times, both in Palestine and in Jordan. But another thing that definitely stood out was when I was a kid, I spent a lot of my time over there defending America, something you won't hear me doing now. And I spent a lot of my time here in the United States defending Arabs. So despite, you know, everything I saw over there, I didn't believe my family members when they'd tell me that United States foreign policy lends to this and has made the situation so much worse. I just wanted to fit in. I wanted to be a regular teenager. I didn't want to be raised in this strict little Arabic bubble, and my parents were really strict. They had five girls, and I was the first one, and so, you know, they had to make sure that I didn't set a bad example for my sisters. So this was the case. I really just went out of my way to be an American until the first Gulf War happened, until Iraq invaded Kuwait back in August of 1990. And then the American rhetoric about war and sanctions started flying. And my instant reaction to that was, no, all I could think of was Iraqi children starving and you know, being bombed and being killed. And all of a sudden, it was like I was a born-again Arab. And I started caring. And I started researching all the things that my relatives would tell me about American foreign policy and how detrimental it was to the region. And so I was very outspoken against the war. This was my senior year in high school. I was very outspoken against the war, and I consistently argued with teachers and with students against the war. And this was a chance, because for those of you who remember the first Gulf War, many of you I think are too young, but for those of you who remember the first Gulf War, at one point Saddam was lobbing Scud missiles at Israel, and people were asking me questions. Why is he doing that? And so I started telling them about Palestine and about the Palestinians and about what had happened in Palestine. And I don't think that I was very good at articulating the connection back then, because I wasn't sure that I even fully understood it. But people didn't even know what a Palestinian was. So I had to explain to them what the Palestinians, who we are, where we come from. And then in January of 1991, the bombs actually started dropping. And suddenly my family stood out. We would get stared at. I think we were one of three families in the small town in Ohio where we grew up. It was a town of about 10,000. There were three Arab families. We were one of them. I was the only Arab American girl in my class. Actually, I was only the only Arab American in my class. So people started making up rumors. Mind you, we're a family of five girls, and there was a rumor that I had a brother fighting in the Revolutionary Guard. And then there was my personal favorite, that we had Scud missiles in our garage. Patients actually started removing their files from my dad's medical practice. They started transferring to other doctors. We got death threats to the house. My father got death threats to his office, literally said, pack up and leave or we'll kill you. And I definitely found out as a senior in high school who my real friends were. Because of all my talk about Palestinians, one of my history teachers made an attempt, a botched attempt, and I'll tell you why it was botched in a minute, to teach about Palestine. So he started the class by saying the State of Israel was created in 1948 as a result of the Holocaust, and instantly my hand went up. And he didn't call on me. I was kind of this pesky 17-year-old who was too opinionated for his taste, I think. He didn't call on me, so I spoke out anyway. I said, that's not true. I can't allow you to teach that. And so the next hour, or however long our high school classes were, consisted of him trying to teach this false narrative and me interrupting him and making sure that people knew that that's not why the State of Israel was actually created. Now, he wasn't being malicious. He was making a genuine attempt to teach what he thought had actually happened. And this is part of that false narrative that I was just talking about a little bit ago. This is part of erasing our memory from Palestine. And so this went on, and I continued to argue with my teacher and to argue with other students, and this took place both in and out of class. And then one day, the Secret Service showed up at my high school looking for me. It just so happened that I had stayed home that day because the night before, the United States had hit a bomb shelter with one of our so-called smart bombs, and the pictures of the children being burned and incinerated, and they were horrifying to me. They actually made me physically sick. This was my first exposure to something like this as an adult. And so my parents let me stay home. But it turns out that after one of my many arguments against the war, one of the students in one of the classes that I was in decided to make up a rumor that I had threatened the President of the United States. It was Bush Senior at the time. And he made up a rumor that I had threatened the President's life, which didn't happen. But he went home and he told his parents this, and his parents decided that as a 17-year-old Arab, I was a threat, and so they called the Secret Service, and the Secret Service showed up at my high school. The teacher who was in class that day was called out of his classroom when the Secret Service came to the high school. And he said, you know, this is absurd. She didn't say anything like that. She voiced an opinion in opposition to the war, as opposed to almost every other student in the classroom who was 100% for the war. Anyway, the Secret Service left, but the principal called my house that day to see if I was okay. I think that they knew what was happening. And they told my mom what had happened, and then my mom came and told me. And then it was published in a local newspaper, but because I was a minor at the time, they couldn't use my name. So they said, Arab American senior is accused of threatening President Bush's life. I was the only Arab American senior there was, so everybody knew who they were talking about. But that was an attempt, again, a botched attempt, to silence opposition. It was an attempt to continue the false narrative. And now the false narrative wasn't just about Israel anymore and Palestine. It was also about Iraq, and it was about American foreign policy, because creating these false narratives isn't just unique to Palestine. So you'll hear other instances of this from our panel. You'll hear about attempts to dehumanize. Rasmiya's case is a prime example of the attempt to silence activism and to silence advocacy and to silence the truth on behalf of Palestine, and it's an example of dehumanization. And, you know, the harassment and persecution of activists with FBI raids are also examples of that. So we're being opposed pretty aggressively right now. We have two bills. We have one in the Illinois legislature opposing BDS, and we have one in Congress opposing and trying to stifle BDS. In 2014, more Palestinians were killed than any year since 1967. So we have to continue this fight, because the aggressive, rabid opposition to us is just evidence that they're afraid that we're winning. It's evidence that we're turning the tide. It's evidence that they fear BDS and that they fear the successful SJP campaigns, the divestment campaigns on various campuses throughout the country. And I think one thing that we really need to remember in continuing this fight is that there are parallels between defending the Palestinian cause and between defending our civil liberties here in the United States. So when we defend the right of people to advocate for Palestine, it's not just a win for Palestine. It's a win for American civil liberties and for equality everywhere.
Our next speaker is Rania Salim, who's a rising sophomore at Loyola University. She became a part of SJP when the year started and became a part of the executive board as a freshman representative, where she actually helped organize Loyola Divest, which passed. This upcoming year, Rania has been elected as SJP's new secretary, and she is a Palestinian woman with both a life in America and in Palestine. Please help me welcome Rania.
Hello, everyone. I'm going to read this poem that I wrote, and it'll give you a little glimpse of my Palestinian story. I am hope, I am courage, I am strength, I am freedom. I am truth, I am sadness, I am fear. I am catastrophe, I am tragedy. I am death. I am 6 and I hear bombs drop. I am 8 and I feel tears burn. I am 7 and I saw doors smashed. I am 12 and I felt the pointer of their gun right against my skull. I am 9 and I touched my mother's face as she cried for her brother. Mother, where is my uncle? I am 10 and I'm choking for air. Air, air, I can't breathe. It's 4 a.m., bombs drop. It's 2 a.m., tanks watch. It's 3 a.m., soldiers run. It's 4 p.m., AK-47s clings tightly around their hands. It's 9 a.m., the fence is long. It's 5 p.m., the sadness strong. The wall, I smell fire. Is that fire? I'm scared, alhamdulillah, I'm scared. Alhamdulillah, are you there? Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, help, I can't breathe. Alhamdulillah, are you dead? Alhamdulillah, don't die, please don't die, don't leave me. The wall, does it say free? It's August, you cannot go through. It's June, you cannot go through. It's May, silly girl, you cannot go through. The doors, but the doors are open. I see the trees, I see my beautiful olive trees, but the doors seem so far away. The card that I hold is green, it's my identification, and I cannot enter. My vision feels heavy, my heart beats loud, I feel stuck and I can't move, cramped, hiding fear, the doors, they broke them, why are they allowed to enter? No, you cannot take them, uncle, father, no, please don't kill them, cousin, brother, no, don't take them. Silly girl, don't you know who we are? We are occupation, we hold superiority, we are oppression. You are a little girl, you are nothing, not even human. Silly, petty little girl, death is your only option. Your rights are limited to none, you are the color green. Your only form of defense is a small rock. Alhamdulillah, are you there? Did you hear them? I am 8, I hear bombs drop. I am 6, I hear bombs drop. I am 9, I hear bombs drop. I am 18, I hear bombs drop. It's summer. I see empty, lifeless eyes. It's 1999, the wall is tall. It's 2003, the wall is tall. It's 2010, the wall is tall. It's 2015, the wall is tall. Genocide, occupation, injustice, death. I am six. Apartheid. It's summer. Is he going to pull the trigger? I am seven. Interrogation was not fun. I am 10. Interrogation was long. I am 12. You cannot go through. I am 16. I am the color green. God, where is Handala? I am six. Why have I been open to death? My flesh, it burns. Mommy, it hurts. Grandma, where is my uncle? I am a child. Why was a gun pointed at a child screaming? I hear screaming. She's crying for her son. You are not even human. You are a green card. The only thing you'll know is death. Handala, they are wrong. I am hope, I am strength, I am courage, I am freedom. I am red, I am white, I am black, I am green. I am a flag, I am proud, I am smiling, I am waving. I am freedom. My olive trees grow taller than their walls of apartheid. My sun burns brighter than their fire of their oppression. My voice screams louder than the voice of their bombs. My fight is strong enough to break this oppression. Did you hear me, occupation? I am hope, I am strength, I am courage. Did you see me, occupation? I am six, I am 12, I am 18. Did you feel me, occupation? I am the life within the trees, the warmth within the sun, the strength within the rocks. Remember me, Israel. I am Palestine. Fear me, Israel. I am a Palestinian. I am breaking open these chains. I am going to enter. You cannot deny me my freedom anymore. I am green, but I am red. I am white. I am black. You may have taken my land. You may have taken my rights. You may have taken my people. But you have not taken my faith. You have not taken my humanity. You have not taken my identity. I am a Palestinian, and you cannot take that away from me. You have destroyed my land. You have destroyed my home. You have destroyed my home. But I am Palestine, and you cannot destroy me. I am hope. I am strength. I am courage. I am freedom. Handala, did you hear that? I am hope. I am strength. I am courage. I am freedom. I am Palestine. First, I want to start talking about Loyola Divas, passed three times now. As a freshman, this was my first actual campaign. We had to organize every day for 3 weeks, and when I wasn't physically doing stuff, I was mentally thinking divestment. And it was really hard, to be quite honest. It was frustrating for me to see a few people put their heart and soul into it and struggle so much. It was their work that made this campaign so successful. Everyone who was a part of divestment, they made it beautiful. They made it worth it. And we were all in this together, and it was powerful. I mean, we had more than 20 organizations endorse and sign on to divestment. We worked so unbelievably hard, and it paid off because Loyola's campus now knows who we are and what we do. We met so many people who have become involved with SJP because of divestment. And so many people began to support us in this cause. I've never actually cried because of Palestine. But that day when divestment was presented to Senate, right before the presentation of divestment, opposition presented their argument for dialogue. And just hearing one Zionist talk about it just sounded like complete lies to me. And I honestly couldn't handle it. I walked out of the room and I cried. I cried because anyone who does not know of the things my people have been through are going to hear his lies and maybe believe them. I would like to clarify that I was born in America, but I have a Palestinian citizenship.
The next speaker is Sahad, and Sahad was born in Algeria to ethnically cleansed Palestinian refugees. Dr. Sahar Halabi is a Palestinian-American physician who practices pulmonary. Yes.
Just do
this. This area. and critical care medicine at Edward Hines VA Hospital. Sahar has worked with various Palestinian organizations, including the Palestinian Children Relief Fund, where she treated hundreds of Palestinians in the occupied territories. Sahar has volunteered with the British Red Cross, where she helped implement a program that supported Bosnian refugees. Sahar currently volunteers with Marjorie.
Marjorie.
Kovla. Yeah, I got it. Sentry, a Chicago-based organization that supports and treats torture victims. Sahad is a member of the Arab-Jewish Partnership, an organization that strives for Jewish and Palestinian equality in Palestine.
So before I start, I just thought I'd share this with you. Rania was talking about being mistaken for a Pakistani, right, from Pakistan. So Palestine, Pakistan. So I got it. I thought, all right, I'm not going to say I'm from Palestine. I'm going to say I am Palestinian. Makes sense, right? Except that once I was at a bar and, this person asked me where I came from and I said I'm Palestinian. So he turns to his friend and he says, she's Pakistinian. All right. So first of all, I would like to thank the Students for Justice in Palestine, Colombia, for inviting me tonight, providing me with this fantastic platform so that I can share with you some of my experiences as a Palestinian from diaspora. Again, I would like to salute the SJP on their bravery and their persistence in the face of adversity. As you know, Palestinians come in different shapes and forms and identities and backgrounds, and I come from the people that were expelled in 1948, when Israel was created. What Israel is now, this is where I come from. People come from Gaza. Some people come from the West Bank. We are all Palestinians, and this body had been dissected time and time again. So to start at the beginning, I would like to state that to be born in a family of refugees and diaspora meant that the identity that is normally shaped in childhood by the amalgamation of belonging, of having that sense of security, of course, was not something that was afforded to this Palestinian child. So I was born in North Africa, in Algeria, to be precise. My father was born in Haifa, and my mother was born in Acre. Those two ancient port cities in North Palestine are bathed by warmth, the warmth of the sun, the warmth of the Mediterranean, and they are surrounded by orange groves and vineyards, beyond which in the east lay the lush and perpetual green slopes of the hills of the Galilee. In 1948, my parents were expelled. They were children. They were expelled through the fear and terror that were waged upon them by the Zionist terror groups. I'm going to tell you the story from my mother's family, but it's not fair for my father, so I'm going to just say this quickly. I was in Palestine between Haifa and Tiberias, a long road, and my dad and I were having a cup of coffee on the road, and he said to me, he pointed to the hills, and he said, this is the route that we took when we fled on foot. He said, we had nothing with us but the clothes that we had on our bodies. They would walk by night and would hide during the day, 3 days and three nights, because the Zionist terrorist groups were still shooting at them, still, as they are fleeing. Anyway, so the state of statelessness is a very curious one. For what shapes a person is invariably linked to that of a group, and what defines the group is the continuous existence, is the continuous presence in a geographical space. And that, of course, is linked to events that are past and events to come. But all of that, all those layers of history, of heritage, of civilizations over millennia, all of it came to a screeching halt in 1948. And Palestine was no more. So Nevertheless, my heritage is deeply implanted in my veins, and that's when I decided, I always wanted to, I could not because I was a refugee with a Syrian travel documents for Palestinian refugees. I had no citizenship and nowhere to say or to claim as home. And I went back at the first opportunity to claim my heritage. I had to relive it. And that was when I visited Palestine for the first time. In Acre, I looked for my mother's house. And this is what I would like to recount with you today. On that day, it was almost dusk. But darkness descended quickly on the ancient port. Acre was to succumb to another night in early November. The air was lofty, and the scent of fresh coffee mixed with a mild sea breeze filled my lungs. A vague wave of nostalgia stemming from some obscure source had wrapped itself warmly around me. This déjà vu was a very welcome certainty amongst all the doubts that come with a rootless existence. Outside the walled old town of Acre, lampposts emitting bright lights were lining the streets like soldiers standing still and silent. The tawny halos naturally shook me back to reality. This was in the year 2009, and I am walking aimlessly out of the old town, wondering as to where the house once stood. I knew that it was turned into the city hall by the Israeli occupation in May 1948. I also knew that it was demolished decades ago, so the trail followed the trail of the city hall and where it once stood. So the house was built by Ehsan, my grandfather, on a plot of land that was a gift from his father-in-law to my grandmother, Sumaya, in 1923. The intention was that she would build Beit al-Umr, the house of a lifetime. It's the house that they were supposed to live, supposed to die. They would see their children grow up, finish their education, get married, fill the house with the laughter of the wee ones, the grandchildren, who will surely become the rightful owners in decades to come. The construction of the limestone three-story house was completed in 1927, and the young, handsome couple with their two sons moved in. In her bedroom on the second floor, Sumaya then gave birth to six more children. Yes, we do procreate and reproduce and move on. Everything was about to change, and change forever. So as I wandered around in the vacant lot where the city hall was, there was some sort of conspicuous void. There's gravel and small stones, they were everywhere. I could see the sharp elevation of the land in the periphery, and that was a telltale sign that once upon a time, not in the too distant past, a building was there. We all know, ladies and gentlemen, that like trees that have their roots in the earth, so do houses. You can demolish a house. You're not going to demolish the foundation. The foundations, just like a society, like us, will remain hidden under the surface of the earth. And that I knew. So I walked around, shuffling along, digging the earth with small kicks. And there it was. I found what I was looking for. I was home at last. But let me tell you about the house that had dug itself inside me, because the story of the old large house was always a constant in my childhood, and not because, you know, repetition and stories and so on and so forth, but because it was a palpable entity, which I could almost touch with my imagination for people, for Palestinians in diaspora who'd never been home. Palestine meant nothing to us, and at the time, I mean, meant nothing geographic to us, and at the time, we didn't have the internet, and there was a boycott, and you just could not see pictures of Palestine unless someone had taken a picture and posted it somewhere. So, anyway, so I knew all the stories by heart. As Haifa fell to the Israeli forces, particularly the Carmeli Brigade, in April in 1948, the systematic ethnic cleansing of its Palestinian population had now gathered speed. It was at its earnest. A chap by the name of Mordechai Maklev, who was the operation officer of the brigade, of the Carmeli Brigade, had ordered his troops to, quote, kill any Arab you encounter, torch all inflammable objects and force doors open with explosives, end quote. Under the relentless shelling, the Palestinians in Haifa fled to Acre across the bay, half an hour drive by car. And Acre was to remain part of the Arab state by the infamous partition plan. They thought they'll be safe there. So Ihsan and Sumaya were restless and apprehensive. They could see Haifa from Acre. Fear permeated the air. Because around that same time, what happened was my mother and her two cousins were afflicted by typhoid fever. They were only some of the victims that fell prey to this sudden epidemic. All of a sudden, years later, as my mother recounted to me her illness, she stated that her suspicions as how the epidemic struck Acre, it was the Haganah, she said. And I don't know about you, but I think that you don't always believe what your mother says. In fact, hardly so. I'm one of them. But she was right. Shamefully, I'm saying she is right, because years later, I came across documents from the International Red Cross at the time, and they documented that the water supply of the city had been poisoned by no other than the Haganah. The Haganah is a Zionist terrorist group, which later formed one of a nucleus, or one of the nuclei of the Israeli army, the so-called Israeli Defense Forces. Anyway, so for the family, naturally, the welfare of the young ones was on everyone's mind. It was very important. They had to be taken into safety. So aged four, along with her two sisters and her brother, my mother was put in a car and driven away with a family member to Tyre in Lebanon. And she was a lucky one. She was driven away. She didn't have to walk on foot. Still, it hurts. A few days later, Sumaya, my grandmother, had made the short 25-mile journey to Tyre in Lebanon to bring back her children, leaving behind Ihsan, her husband, and the two teenage sons. In the meantime, as she goes to fetch her children, Acre falls to the Haganah. The borders are closed. There's no going home for the refugees, no going home for the rightful owners. The Palestinians were not to return. And just imagine, in the space of an hour drive away, all was lost. Sumaya was never to see her house again, her life, her history, her heritage, her land, her laughter, her morning coffee, her embroidery, her tears, her father's tombstone, her wedding pictures, her fig trees, her birth bangs, her freshly washed sheets, her scented towels, her pickled aubergines, her jars of olives, her mother's gold bracelets, her sea, her garden, her lace, her scarves, her orange groves. They were all gone, just like that. Sumaya simply ceased to exist. Ihsan and Sumaya reunited in Lebanon, but as the weeks and the months slowly crawled by, turning into years and decades, the hope of return was eroded. It was slowly and painfully pulled out of their souls, leaving behind a trail of tears, yearning hearts, and unquenchable longing. My grandmother, Sumaya, passed away in 1985, having lived the ethnic cleansing of al-Nakba in 1948, endured the uprooting, buried two of her children, witnessed four wars, and survived an early widowhood. On her deathbed, her long black hair had turned silver white. Her high cheekbones that once framed that cheerful smile of youth are now bordering her sunken cheeks. She had a sparkle in her eyes when she was young, but that sparkle of the dark eyes of the besotted, young, shy bride, were now hollowed and empty, like two dried wells. On her deathbed, with her consciousness waxing and waning, she would shed a tear or two and murmur a few words, pleading with whomever happened to be listening. "I only want to see Akka one last time." No God answered her prayer. So now I'm standing on Sumaya and Ihsan's land, kicking the earth to see what's underneath. I struck something solid. I look down to see red and blue colors peeping shyly. I bend down to move the earth, and the old design of the intertwined blue and red curved lines of the tiles appear. And I understood. These were the tiles of the floors on which my mother took her first and steady steps. The floors that were treaded thousands of times, no doubt, by my uncles running out of school. The floors on which stood loving friends and relatives as they were welcomed in or kissed goodbye. I'm holding the fragments of the tiles in my hands. This is what Sumaya was dreaming of as she drew her last breath. I weep. So, the human catastrophe went beyond that simple geographic displacement of us. That was not enough. Our history was to be assassinated. It was to be to have its corpse dismembered and thrown in the bowels of the earth to Hayden with a prayer that it would never resurrect. When I visited Akka, just as an example, in 2012, the vacant lot where the house once stood was turned into a public park. There were trees and there were flowers. And ladies and gentlemen, the significance of this is enormous. Many villages in Palestine were razed to the ground and erased from the surface of the earth in order to prevent the Palestinians from returning. That was the primary goal, number one. But on top of that, planting trees and converting the land into public parks is a strategy that is meant to cover up the crime forever. Because one can excavate under buildings or under roads. You cannot pull a tree and look what's underneath it. As for the ethnically cleansed, they were supposed to vanish into thin air. Their memory was supposed to be assigned into oblivion. the saying went by, the old will die and the young will forget. Well, nevertheless, it is true the old did die, but the young did not forget. And in the words of Mahmoud Darwish, the famous Palestinian poet, a voice escaped from the night of the crime. And that voice is us, and we cannot be stifled. So, on a happy note, life goes on, and how the life goes on, as the Beatles song goes. It's life is the very essence of life, is growth and its perseverance. So, look at us. Fast forward to the third millennium. We are still here. We are still here, alive and kicking and remembering and making others know what really went on. As we gather here to share our stories, I would like to share with you this, that I've always envisaged injustice as a living organism. That it grows, it reproduces, it makes more injustices, and they go on as such. But so does perseverance. So does existence. And this is how we come to exist and live on, and immortally so. This is what resistance is, refusal to be obliterated. So thank you for your patience, and thank you for listening to all of the above. And I would like to conclude by highlighting this spectacular efforts that we all and you are all putting in, because to face the propaganda machinery that is hard bent on covering up the crimes, distorting facts, twisting history, wrecking human lives, and silencing free speech, to face all that, ladies and gentlemen, is precisely what Rudyard Kipling was referring to when he said in his famous poem, if you can hear the truth you've spoken, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to broken and stoop and build them up with worn out tools. If you can talk to crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings, nor lose the common touch. If neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if every man count with you, but none too much. If you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it. And, which is more, you will be a man, my son, or woman, in the spirit.
And lastly, we have Rasmiya Ouda, who received her master's degree in criminal justice, a community organizer in the past 10 years, and associate director of AAAN, American Arab Action Network, where she founded the Women's Committee and helped many, many, many people. So please give me a... help me in giving Rasmiya a warm welcome.
Really, what they said, they spoke about their parents' and family's experience. I know it's also my experience, personal experience, and general, my whole people experience. They didn't leave anything for me to speak. I'm not going to speak about personal. I'm going to speak about general, because I believe the general, my life and experience is part of the general. So I will speak about general. And I will speak about Palestinian women and the impact of the occupation. The organizers, Ahmad, asked me to be one of the Palestinian women telling their stories tonight. but I prefer to consider it an evening of recognition of the Palestinian woman, especially our martyrs and those who are political prisoners in Israeli jails. The ones who face endless assaults from the Israeli military occupation. These women continue to stand up for their rights and for justice. I'm a Palestinian woman. I was born and grew up in a war zone, as did all the women who have lived in Palestine since 1947. I have been struggling with my people for close to 7 years. Always I said I'm 19 years old. Under Israel's illegal colonial military occupation and its oppressive and racist practices. The Israelis committed massacres and its oppressive and racist practices. The Israelis committed massacres and expelled the Palestinians from our homes and lands at gunpoint in 1947 and 1948. This was followed by another war in 1967 when they occupied the rest of Palestine. The military occupation terrorized Palestinians, especially women. The Israeli forced deliberately target a large number of Palestinian women and their families, shielding them while in their homes. The military checkpoints and the apartheid wall prevent the unity of families and keep patients from reaching health centers and hospitals. Many women have been deprived of their right to natural childbirth, forced to give birth at checkpoints inside of Israeli soldiers. Some of these women lost their babies in childbirth. Israel holds 36 Palestinian women, including some who are pregnant, and 156 children under 18 years in the jails. Palestinian and Israeli human rights organizations both report that torture is still used against them. In addition, Israel is impoverishing Palestinian families, confiscating their land and water resources. Palestinian women suffer greatly as a result of these practices. The policy of demolishing homes and killing children, husbands, sisters, and brothers, depriving women of quality of life, violates women's rights specifically and more generally the Fourth Geneva Convention, United Nations Resolution, and World Health Organization Regulation. This is the real face of Israel for almost 70 years. We have known nothing but violence and ethnic cleansing against my people. Many years of negotiation for a political settlement have been a huge failure because Israel continuously demands recognition of the Jewishness of the state, which goes against all notions of equality and democracy. And because it returned self-determination, equality, and independence. Palestinian women carry a huge burden to protect themselves, their children, and their families from Israeli shelling of residential area. In the absence of safe and secure places to meet the family's needs. Women are responsible for providing food, alternative shelter, and care for the wounded, as well as protecting their families in case of house demolition, curfews and arrests, or killing of the husbands, daughters, or sons, which puts them in a position alone as a head household. Palestinian women face other abuses which affect their physical and mental health, such as being prevented access to hospital and maternity health center. Many have been forced to give birth at home, which places their lives and the lives of their newborns as massive risk. In addition, under occupation, education is consistent, especially in the villages, which result in increased rates of early marriage and the continued destruction of the entire social, economic, and cultural life of Palestinian women. Despite these conditions, Palestinian women do not give up. They always move forward to play powerful and important roles in the promotion of the legendary steadfastness shown by the Palestinian people through the tasks handled by the community as part of its traditional role as family, attempting to soften the effects of poverty, which have reached extraordinary levels in Palestinian society. Also, none of us should forget Palestinian women's role in the educational process, which initiated the formation of alternative schools in cases of curfews. And they were the first Palestinian sector to express their rejection of military occupation by organizing demonstrations defending young people at risk of arrest and freeing children from the hands of soldiers who were arresting them in the streets. Palestinian women have historically participated in different forms of struggle, exposing themselves to arrest and martyrdom. Now 35 are languishing in Israel prison, some of them pregnant. I'm very proud to tell you that despite all the difficult conditions imposed on the Palestinian women's movement, they are still bravely moving forward to build a modern society and defend their legal rights. There's a great awareness of the importance of this phase, which drafted laws defining the obligations of Palestinian society to the international system. Feminist frameworks within the human rights and civil society organizations are reviewing family law. and providing the basis for urgent modifications, such as the age of marriage and the right of women in marriage, divorce, alimony, polygamy, child custody, and inheritance. These modifications have been provided to the Palestinian Legislative Council and the Chief Justice of the Palestinian Supreme Court. The challenges for the Palestinian woman are very difficult, but every one of them believe that challenges are not frightening, and as long as we believe in our rights and the principle that we stand for, have confidence in ourselves and rise up together, we become stronger and more effective. Then we can achieve our goals and beyond. Before I finish, I would like to thank every one of you, those who I have already met before and those who I have not yet met. I'm sure that all of us have the same hope and dream that we have dedicated our lives to. We all stand for social justice and liberation in this country, the same way my people have dedicated their lives to the liberation of Palestine. Also, I would like to remark that you are the young generation who can lead us and provide the oxygen that we need to breathe. You are responsible for continuing the struggle to achieve justice, freedom, and own capabilities with the wisdom and experience of the older generation to ensure that you achieve your dream and your goals, because your dreams and your goals belong to all of us. And last, but not least, I want to thank the organizers and all SJP and the volunteers of this event to support the Palestinian women and their families to stand up strongly in their struggle to end the Israeli occupation and to achieve the Palestinian goals of return, self-determination, and independence. They need your support and your solidarity. Together, we will achieve justice and freedom and make positive change and a better future for our communities all over the country and the world. Your support and commitment means everything to us. Thank you and wish you all the best.